Hi, everybody. My name is David Moore, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
And because the program works, I've been sober since August 24th, 1980. And I'm extremely grateful for that today. And technically, it's the Texoma Foxhall group of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to look it up, it's Texoma Foxhall, located in Sherman, Texas. And we're having our newcomers meeting tonight. And my thoughts are with them. And I love coming to, I decided when I was sitting there that, you know, there's a name for this. It's enthusiastic, but this is like a whoop-whoop group, you know? I mean, it's like, whoop-whoop, you know? And I like to holler, you know? I like to go to AA and get involved and holler and scream and see what kind of, see if we can outdo each other in our enthusiasm. And I learned that years and years ago, because I found there's two things that are contagious in AA. One is enthusiasm. Okay, you know, if you're screaming and hollering, you might get the guy, he'll just start screaming and hollering. And, you know, and the other thing is apathy. Apathy is contagious in AA. And I've been to groups where you walk in and it's like, you know, what do you want? You know, and like you're there to steal their sobriety or something. And they're just not opening up to you. So I love coming to enthusiastic AA. It's made all the difference in my life. Plus the principles that your group is founded on, and primarily the number one being submitting to the principle of sponsorship, agreeing to have a sponsor and be sponsored, and then being a sponsor. Those things have been real important. That's why I'm standing here tonight, because of those things. But let me tell you all what happened, what it's like, and what happened, what it's like, and what it's like today. It's been real strange the last few months or so. I don't know why I've done this. I've started looking up all my old buddies from when I grew up, and I've managed to make contact with most of them and talk to them. But I grew up not too far from here over in Lake Highlands, and I had, you know, I was always wanting more, but I had everything that I needed when I was growing up. My parents, I was adopted, and my parents told me when I was young, and I know today that adopted parents are extra sensitive, because I know that my mother was always afraid that she was going to be criticized as not being a good enough mother. And so she tried extra hard, you know, to give us and be just a picture-perfect mom. And I have to say this, that after I got sober, you know, I'm going to jump around. My talk's not linear, so you just have to get used to it. But when I got sober in the early 80s, it became quite fashionable to blame everything on your parents. I mean, when one of those speakers, I won't mention, but they wrote a lot of books about that kind of stuff, would come to town, the AA clubs were empty. You know, where's everybody? Well, they're not at the convention center here in so-and-so. Talk about that. Some of those people made it back. Some of them got drunk, you know. But I'm ashamed to say that that was something that I did. I took part in that. Today, one of the things that I do is I try and make it absolutely part of my amends to my parents is that, you know, my mother and my father separately, is that the way I turned out had absolutely nothing to do with them, and that they probably kept me alive. They weren't enablers. They kept me alive, and that was real important. My alcoholism is my responsibility, because as long as I'm a victim and they did it to me, then I'm not going to get well. You know, I'm just going to be, I'm gonna hang on the cross, as they used to say. I've heard a particularly, you know, sometimes we have that fourth and fifth step, and being a sponsor, one time I heard something, and it was kind of, wow, and I called my dad. I said, I want to meet you for lunch. And I was trying to express something. I said, you know, Dad, you weren't that bad a father. And he said, that's okay. You weren't that good a son. And I said, all right. Anyway, I found out what an alcoholic was when I was real young. I used to go spend time with my grandparents up in Oklahoma. And that was they lived in Tuttle. And Tuttle today is the home of Brahms. But back then, Tuttle had one flashing red light. And I would go spend summers with them, and occasionally my grandfather would go to Chickasha, which is the county seat of Grady County, and we'd drive over there. And there was a man there, and I still remember him. He was in a wheelchair, and he sat in front of the courthouse, which is usually where I saw him. And to this date, he's still the filthiest human being I've ever seen. He was a white man, but his skin was black. And the way you could tell where the skin stopped and the skin began, the clothes stopped, was the clothes had a sort of a sheen, you know, like they were satin, and they reflected light, and the skin didn't reflect light. And he was in a wheelchair, and, you know, you could yellow teeth, and you could see his eyes, and dirty clothes, and he's sitting there, and he's begging in front of the courthouse. As far as I know, he's probably the only beggar in town. And the first time, and I'm from Lake Highlands, right? I mean, I'd never seen anything like that before in my life. First time I saw that, I'm like, Grandpa, what is that? And he told me the guy's name. And I said, what are we going to do? You know, I said, hey, we got to do something. There's something wrong here. And he said, we're not going to do anything. And I remember watching this guy. And I can remember going back home and thinking about him when I was back in Dallas, wondering about this guy. And my father told me about him. And he said, he's a Jake leg. And I didn't know what that was. And he said what this guy did was he made his own hooch, is what Dad called it. And he drank it, and it was a bad batch, and it made him go blind, partially blind and paralyzed. He was an alcoholic. And that's what an alcoholic was that guy sitting in that wheelchair begging in front of the courthouse. So I knew what an alcoholic was, okay? I was also, to make the story kind of unusual, I was adopted by two people who don't drink. And when I say they don't drink, that means they don't drink. Now, some people say, well, my family doesn't drink. But what that means is we don't drink to excess, you know, or we, you know. But on the 4th of July at my house, there was iced tea, okay? There was iced tea on New Year's Eve up until midnight, at which time you got coffee. And that was the drinking. My grandfather did drink every year at Thanksgiving. He had, I guess it was probably the same bottle the whole time I can remember, of Mogan David, and he'd drink three or four little, it probably turned to vinegar, but he didn't care. And it was the only time he drank it, I know. And he'd have three or four little glasses of it and then get all loosey-goosey and try and dance, and they'd make fun of him for the rest of the year. And that was the extent of drinking that I saw growing up. My parents were very careful to shelter me from anybody who drank. We didn't go around people who drank. There were never people who came over and drank. What was insane, though, there was alcohol in my house. And I knew where it was, and I knew it was there, and I thought, you got to be drinking it. I'm just not seeing it. And the alcohol was in the top of the linen closet, and when there was nobody in the house, I'd pull a chair to the linen closet, and that was the first step, and then I'd climb up, and I'd hang, and I'd pull myself up, and there was all these bottles of whiskey, gin, vermouth, vodka, everything you could think of, opened, unopened. Some in paper sacks. I remember a bottle that had the PX label from when my dad was discharged from the Army Air Corps in 1945. Okay, and there was just a little bit gone out of the top. And, you know, it's like, and then I also found four bottles and a decanter set stashed underneath some towels in the other bathroom. I knew where all the booze was. Oh, and there was a hot six-pack of Jack's beer. I'd been there for years. It never went anywhere. I never saw anybody drinking it. And I'm like trying to get them to tell me. It's like, you know, they got to be drinking. You know, I'm obsessed with alcohol, right? I haven't had a drink. But if there's alcohol, it's like having a car and not driving it. It's like having food and not eating it. Somebody's drinking the alcohol. And I'd say, Dad, do you drink? No, we don't drink. Oh, okay. And then he'd have somebody coming over. And I'd say, well, when Mr. So-and-so comes over, are y'all going to drink? No, we don't drink. And I'm like, ugh. One day, I saw my father getting ready to go out of town. He was a sales manager for a large corporation. He would travel to all these Texas cities, and I saw him getting ready to go on this trip, and he went and got one of those bottles, and he got a little funnel and a hip flask out, and he started pouring some whiskey, and then it's like I go, I get it, and I actually shut the door to the bathroom so my mom couldn't hear, and I said, I know what you do, and he said, what, and I said, you go out of town and drink whiskey when you're out of town so mom won't get mad. I mean, it made perfect sense to me. And he said, I'm not going to drink any of this whiskey. And then I just wanted to go bash my head against the wall. You know, boom, boom. Then why do you have it? He took me on a business trip with him one time, and I'll share this with you just because my father's a normal person and does not understand alcoholism. I've been sober 24 years. He was at my house for Thanksgiving, and he's still trying to understand the disease of alcoholism. He's asking questions, okay? But he had kind of a misconception, and we went, the time, I think we went to Lubbock, and he called the employment agency, said who he was with, he's going to be interviewing salesmen. Sets a schedule, they start sending him by the suite. And so I'm just like a little kid, you know, hanging out, kind of bored, you know, and he's interviewing these guys. At one point, if it looks like it's a prospective guy to put in the sales job, Dad goes to his suitcase, opens it up, goes in the bathroom, gets two of those hotel glasses and tears the paper off the top and sets them down and takes that hip flask out and unscrews it. pours two fingers of bourbon in each glass, sets it down with a bottle in front of the guy and says, well, let's have a drink. If the guy took the drink and finished it and asked for another one, he didn't get the job because that was my dad's alcoholic trap. See, he thought an alcoholic was a guy who, when he was presented with alcohol, was like Jack Lemmon in Days of Wine and Roses, where he threw himself through that liquor store window because he just had to drink, you know, that when an alcoholic saw alcohol, he foamed at the mouth and went crazy. I guess it worked for him, except for one guy, and that guy, you know, he's asked me about it. He said, well, you know, he was an alcoholic. And I said, yeah, I know. He was a great guy. I mean, wonderful guy, great personality. And he was Dad's golden boy, and he brought him to Dallas and gave him all these big accounts. But he was an alcoholic, right? So he ran off with the company secretary and embezzled a bunch of money. Left his wife and kids, you know, alcoholic stuff. And my father, many years later, was still baffled why, when he gave him the test, he didn't take the drink. Because he saw him drinking from that point on. And I said, I'll try and explain it to you, but it won't make any sense. And he goes, okay. And I said, Dad, there wasn't enough there. That's just enough to make you mad. And if there's not enough, you don't start. And he went, what? I said, never mind. You know, never mind. Never mind. You don't get it. But you know what? My father doesn't have to understand the disease of alcoholism. And I'll tell you what, he does not understand AA. He doesn't understand the disease of alcoholism. But as luck would have it, I was adopted. So was my younger brother. We're not biologically related. We just came out of the same little orphanage. So was my sister. And my brother and I are both alcoholics. So my parents, when I started drinking when I was about 14, and my brother actually started, he went to jail for the first time when he was 11. So they think it's something that they've done. You know, they're it's tearing their heart out. What did they do? And when I started drinking in earnest, I had no more idea what was going on than they did. You know, this is like in the late 60s, early 70s. I got married when I was 19, and I got a good job. And my wife was pregnant. You know, that's not that unusual. That's why we got married. Mm-hmm. And had a lot of parties over at my house. And had to get rid of some of those people. They were they weren't too careful. And back then, you could a small amount of one of those outside issues could get you. It was a felony. And this other couple we knew, they got busted, and the state took their child away. And so what I did was I said, okay, we're going to get rid of all these people, and we're going to do this. And what we're going to do is we're going to drink. And my wife, who wasn't an alcoholic, said, oh, okay. She didn't even know we had a problem. And I said, yeah, that's what we're going to do. We're going to drink. That's it. And to me, it was like brilliant. And it's almost like my alcoholism was saying, put these drugs down and let's do some drinking. I'm 19 years old, and I started drinking in earnest. I'm still at this job. I'm able to make it every day. You know, at this place, you can do all kinds of things as long as you get there on time. They'll forgive anything. Just get there on time. And so I was able to get there on time. And as I was actually able to retire from there with 30 years not too long ago. And people go, wow. And I go, it's not virtue. Let me tell you. It's because, what finally happened was my wife came in one day and said, I love you, I always have, and I probably always will, but my daughter and I deserve better than to sit here and watch you kill yourself. And we're leaving. And at the time, I was 24. So I thought, good, you know, good. I got married way too young. And but on the inside, it tore my heart out, but I couldn't admit that. I used to wake up. I went and got me a little nasty single. So it was nasty back then. It's even nastier now down on Greenville Avenue at this place. And my neighbors would sometimes on Sunday morning or Saturday, they go, man, are you okay? And I go, yeah, why? And they go, there was all this crying and screaming coming out of your apartment. Somebody's really crying. And I know what it was, because sometimes I would hear it. I'd be like coming to, not waking up, but coming to. And, you know, it's like your brain's starting to wake up after a night of hard drinking and your eyes are still closed. And I'd hear a noise. Like, what's that noise? What is that? It's somebody crying. Who's crying? It's you. It's me. Oh, my God. And apparently it was loud enough that the neighbors heard it, you know. And so I didn't have any effective tools for dealing with what was going on in my life. And my father and my mother, you know, I ran off all my friends, all the guys that I grew up with. They hung in there with me as long as they could. And they had various, one group of friends suggested that if every time I wanted to drink, if I would just smoke a little pot, I would be okay. And they actually said they were going to come over and give me an alcohol-free weekend. And their big mistake was telling me in advance they were coming to do that. So I had little pints stashed everywhere. They know I normally kept my bottle up here, but now there's... And about 1 o'clock Saturday afternoon, they went, "He's drunk. How did he get drunk?" You know, well, I mean, you know, he tipped me off. I had in the drawer, in the coat pocket, over here. And they all left in disgust. Then I thought, fine, I don't need them anyway. There were friends. I remember one phone call. I remember going to my best friend's wife's birthday party. And the next morning, I remember getting there, and that's all I remember. I just remember walking in the door and all the people and everybody laughing and being happy. And I remember the next morning the phone ringing, and it's him, and he's very upset. And he starts off, "You son of a bitch." And I'm, whoa. And I don't know why he's saying that. And my heart's racing, because he's really angry, so something must have happened, but I can't remember what it was. And I'm stalling, hoping he'll give me some information. And he says, "Why did you do that?" And I'm like going, well, you know, because see, if you don't know what you've done, you're insane, right? I mean, I can forget blank spots, but I did something big. And he said, "My wife cried for an hour after you left." And I'm like, I don't know what to say. My brain's racing. I'm thinking, David, you're insane. You're crazy. And I said, "Dave, you just can't come over anymore." So one by one, my life and my world got smaller and smaller and smaller. My brother, who was going through his own bottom at this time, I had a .38 Smith & Wesson and one cartridge. And the cartridge was in one drawer and the .38 was in the other. And when I would do my little drinking thing, I'd come home. I didn't drink during the day. I drank between 5 and 9 o'clock. And I drank fast and hard until I hit the floor. And that was how I drank. I mean, if you want real glamorous drinking stories about drinking with presidents or something, you're not going to get it, because all I did was I drank, passed out, and hit the floor. I drank to oblivion every night. I could not stand to think about what had happened the night before or the weekend before, or the pain, or the, just like the book says, the consciousness of my intolerable situation. But one day, it was in the afternoon, and I was thinking about what had gone wrong the night before. And it was a Saturday, and my brother came over. And I just share this because it's like alcoholism. And he's a lot bigger than I am, much bigger than I am, much wider than I am, very strong. He's the kind of guy, it's like when you have to move a sofa to the second floor, he'd just grab it and, lift it up over the balcony. And he came over, and... You know, we're brothers, right? And we're drunken brothers, and so we haven't really matured in our relationship. So after about 10 minutes, it's, make me, you know. And I just said, "Get out of here, man. Get out of here, you know. Leave. Go." And then he's like, "Make me." And I thought, I don't have time for this. I'm tired and, you know, got things to worry about. And so I'd never done this before. I knew the gun was empty. The bullet was over here, okay? Only one bullet. And I opened the door, and I pulled that gun out. I pointed at him, and I said, "Get the hell out of here." And I don't want to forget what he did, because he saw the gun, and he dropped to his knees, and he started bawling, and he said, "God, please kill me, please kill me, please kill me." And I just looked at him, and when I saw the pain, and that he was just begging me to kill him, I just said, "Oh, man." I dropped the gun and said, get out of here, get out of here. My brother is sober today. He used to call me drunk, and he'd say, "I need to quit drinking." And I had like a year or two, and so I'd like give him the AA line, and I'd say, "If you can stay sober tomorrow, I'll pick you up and take you to a meeting." And I'd go over there. I'd get all excited about it, and he wouldn't come to the door. Mm-hmm. Or I'd call him on the phone, and he's like, "I gotta go do something." And I'm like, "Oh, you're drunk, you know." And my sponsor said, "Well, you probably are going to have a hard time carrying the message to your brother based on your relationship." So, okay. So I quit. You know, when he'd call, I'd say, "Listen, man, if you want to know about it, It's in the phone book. Give them a call. They'll be glad to help you. You don't want my help. One night, I went to a meeting that I never go to. I've only been to that club maybe a dozen times in all the 24 years I've been sober, but I was there that night. And the treatment center van pulled up, and I heard them all filing in, you know, getting their coffee and go sit on the back row. And I looked up, and my brother was there. And I had no idea. I didn't know he was in treatment. And I didn't get a chance to talk to him because the meeting started. And then he got up and got a desire chip at the end of the meeting. And I went up to him. I couldn't even talk. And what he said was, he said, "I've watched you. And if you can do it, I can do it." And, you know, I drove home that night, and I got about 100 yards down the road. And occasionally in my sobriety, I have cried out of joy and gratitude. And it's just like that Vesuvius. Mm-hmm. I had to pull over. I couldn't drive. It was just like all those things. He's had a rough go. He's had several liver transplants as a result of damage that he did while he was drinking and some other things. But and he's still hanging in there. But anyway, I didn't drink during the day, but I sure drank at night. But they were convinced I was drinking during the day at work. And after I got sober, the supervisor whose job it was to catch me drinking came up and talked to me, because they were trying to get rid of me. They were trying. But I showed up. I was there on time, no matter how hungover. And I could do my job standing on my head. That was the deal. And I was one of those guys, when I showed up for work, you didn't say, "Well, what did you do this weekend?" I mean, it's like, it was more like, "Don't look at it. Don't look at it." You know, I'd come in and my hand would be in a cast, and I'd have a black eye and my glasses would be split. And I used to park my old cars, you know, I went downhill in cars. And I can remember having the whole side caved in, but the other side was pristine. And I would park it so that, you know, out the window you could see the good side. And everybody went out at lunch, you know, and they're like, "What happened to your car?" But by this point, nobody asked. Okay, nobody asked what I did. And, you know, I can remember this was in the, you know, late 70s, and they wouldn't turn the building heat on until like 10 minutes before you got there. So it's like wintertime. Everybody's wearing their coats. It's freezing in the building. And I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm pouring sweat. And they come and they go, "Are you hot?" And I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I didn't know. I knew it was connected to my drinking, but I didn't know. And I would go in the bathroom and sit in the stall, and I would pack my shirt with paper towels and wrap them around my neck and hope that the sweats and the shakes would stop before it was time to go back, before I got in trouble for being gone too long. I finally could no longer not take the morning drink. That was the thing. Don't take the morning drink. I used various chemical things, not in the sense that I was abusing them, but I had to have something to keep me calm so that I could write, talk on the phone, and make it to work, okay? But, you know, I used Valium and a bunch of other stuff. I burned a hole in my stomach with that stuff because, you know, I took a lot of it to keep me from shaking. But by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, what would start to happen is I wouldn't take anymore because it wasn't going to do any good. There was only one thing that was going to work, and that was a drink of alcohol. And I lived about 4 miles away, and I knew if I put it in my car, I'd drink it. So I wouldn't keep it in the car, but I'd start thinking, okay, all right, it's time to go home. I got offered overtime. No, I can't work. You know, I got to go home. And I would get out of there, and I would think, what if I get a flat? I'm driving on the rim. What if the traffic's backed up? And I had alternate routes. You know, I'm going to just go across their front yard, down this alley over here, and I'm going to make it home. And I would race upstairs to that apartment, stand there with my coat on, go pour a great big iced tea glass full of bourbon, put a couple of ice cubes in the top, and stand there with my coat on in the kitchen and drink it. And then the magic happened. And what happened was at that moment, I felt for the first time that day normal. I felt like a normal human being. I felt okay. I had always felt less than up until that moment. And then as soon as that stuff got in me, and you know, I'd be normal for like 15 minutes, you know. But the way I drank, I had to keep drinking, I had to keep drinking, I had to keep drinking, and down I went. Not very glamorous, not very exciting, but that's how it was. Finally, they just backed me in a corner and said, "Son, you got to do something, or we're going to send your stuff home in a cardboard box. What's your choice?" And I was such an animal, the only thing I could think of is they're going to take away my whiskey money. That's all I could think of. Don't take my whiskey money. So I told them I'd go, and they put me in a treatment center for 36 days. And when I was in there, I knew the whole time that I was going to drink when I got out. I figured out real quickly what you were supposed to say. Tell them you're an alcoholic and say yes and agree and nod your head and say, boy, this is a great thing, but you don't really belong here, David. You know why I didn't belong here? Because what was wrong with me was not what was wrong with you. Now, I could see how you looked at me and thought that my problem was alcohol. I could see how you thought that, because on the surface, it looked like that. Yes, I was drinking too much. But what my real problem was, and I had a laundry list of problems, and I remember them very well. The first one was lack of money. I needed more money. And, you know, I bet I could go to just about any club in the world and say, how many of y'all would be okay tonight if you won the lottery? You know, everybody go, yeah, me. I needed money. I suffered from bad parental relationships. My parents didn't treat me right. I had a mean boss. Had a mean ex-wife. I had bad legal representation. I had a bad car, and I lived in a bad neighborhood. And probably number one, I suffered from a lack of love. If I could just find the right girl. You know, we could just, I wouldn't drink so much if I could just find the right girl. Everything would be okay. And today, I will know that I was in a state of mind when I got out of that treatment center, and that state of mind is called not being ready to quit drinking. And there is no substitute, no cure for that other than to go out and experience more pain and humiliation. I've thought about it. You know, if Bill and Dr. Bob could have come back from the grave, our co-founders, and sat down and talked to me, they couldn't have gotten through to me because I did not believe what was wrong with me was what was wrong with you. I thought y'all were the nicest bunch of people, and that I remember thinking, you know, if I ever get things together, I might come back and visit, like church on Sunday, you know? But I couldn't be an alcoholic. One of the things that we do, that we have this extraordinarily powerful tool here. It's so powerful. You know, it talks in our literature that, you know, a lot of people are afraid to use it, but that we can use it. We can use this tool because we have a solution, and the tool is the truth. Even though that voice in my head, when people would say, well, I've been to prison, the voice would say, I've only been to jail. I've never been to prison. I can't be an alcoholic. You know, I've had four ex-wives. Well, see, I've only had one ex-wife, so I can't be an alcoholic. There was that thing that was constantly running, trying to find the differences between me and you. Okay? It was just going all the time. When that kind of thinking is going in somebody's head, you can't stop it. Like my old sponsor used to say, the only way to stop it is with pain. There's no other way, and desperation. I had to go out and experience a little bit more humiliation and degradation. And I look back on it today, and I'm so lucky it only lasted 6 months. But I can remember I set out to prove that what y'all said about alcoholics and alcoholism did not apply to me. That can't be me. And I can remember clearly laying on the floor of my apartment, being so passed out that I couldn't move, you know, but my brain is wide awake, and I'm arguing with myself that I can't be an alcoholic. That can't be me. The end finally came for me, and I thought it was the end, but it turned out to be the beginning. One Sunday, and it was in a house about a mile and a half from here. And it was what I called an all underwear weekend. they deliver pizzas and you get enough half gallons and you're not, you know, nobody's come to see you and you're not going anywhere. You know, that old Michelob commercial, it doesn't get any better than this. You know, got plenty of ice cubes and that's where I'll be. And one Sunday evening I came to, and it was about 5 o'clock, and what I had to do was go in, pour a great big glass of bourbon, drink it so I could pass out, so I could get up, so I could go to work, so I could make more money, so I could buy more whiskey, so I could keep living this way. What I wanted to do was not quit drinking forever, not become, you know, a sunbeam of Jesus and Alcoholics Anonymous. What I wanted to do was not take that next drink. I just didn't want to have to get up and take that drink. And I'd always told myself that, you know, y'all talked about powerlessness and all that. And I thought, man, I couldn't even imagine what y'all were talking about, because I knew that somewhere deep down inside me, I had that power. I just never called on it. I never tried hard enough, but it was there. And so laying there that night, not wanting to have to take that drink and pass out, I called on that power. I looked inside me. I went all the way down. And I think if you'd have had a camera focused on me, I'm just laying there in this bed, not moving. I don't even know if I would have had any expression on my face. But I'm like reaching down to my soul, trying to find the power to not take that drink, and I came up empty. And I had, you know, we act like it's such a big deal. Okay, what happened was that I saw for just a moment what everybody else already knew. We act like it's a big revelation, you know, like the clouds part and you get to see yourself. But hell, everybody that knew me, if I'd have called people up and said, listen, Mom, I'm thinking about drinking a fifth of bourbon tonight. And I know I crashed my car last night and went to jail, but I really think I can handle it tonight. Do you think that's a good idea? I don't think I could find anybody who says, yes, David, I think it's a good idea. I think you should drink some more. Nobody, okay? But they already knew I was out of control. They knew that alcohol owned me. And what happened was I had that realization and I saw the truth. I saw who and what I was. And then I saw, it's kind of like the ghost of Christmas future. I saw what was going to happen to me. And that is that I was going to die this lonely, cold heart death from a disease of alcoholism, and there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. And it wasn't a lack of money. It wasn't poor legal representation. And it wasn't not finding her. And it wasn't the car. And it wasn't where I lived. And it wasn't my ex-wife. And it was none of those things. It was me, and that it was, I was, like they said, I was an alcoholic, and I knew what it meant to be powerless over alcohol. And that's, I know today, that's when I took the first step. Was I happy and full of hope and joy? No, that was about the darkest moment I've ever had in my life. It was awful. Did I come back to AA? Yes. Why? Because I couldn't think of anywhere else to go. Did I think it would work? No. I came here really because I couldn't think of anything else. I came back thinking you were going to say, where have you been? All you do is look at me. You knew where I'd been. Nobody asked me that. They said, oh, man, we're so glad to see you. Come in and have a seat. Would you like some coffee? Come on in, sit down. I thought, I don't deserve this. I don't deserve this. I thought I had it all cause and effect. You know, you do something good, you get something good. You know, you save a school bus from going off the edge of a cliff, and God rewards you with sobriety. You know, And then this thing happened. I had a sponsor. I hadn't worked any steps. And I've got like a month or two. And I'm sitting there. And all I'm doing is I'm getting up every day. And I'm going to a meeting that night. I'm just listening. I was so nervous. All I could do was practice saying, my name's David. I'm an alcoholic and I pass. I was saying that over and over and over to myself, thinking that if they called on me, I would just say that. And then I would be so nervous, I would screw it up royally. And everybody would like, you know. I was like, Dave, pass, and they're like. And I spent my time, I remember this in meetings, drying my hands on my jeans. If any of y'all done that, I was a sweater and a shaker, okay? And I spent my time drying my hands because I didn't want those good, decent people that smelled good and were dressed nice to have to hold that nasty hand. And I just knew that they were going to recoil in horror, and that the only reason they held my hand was because it was just too embarrassing to walk away. There were a couple of times where nice, clean, dressed-up people would sit next to me, and I would think, oh, they sat here because it's the only seat, and that they wouldn't have sat here. This almost kept me from getting this deal, okay? This almost took me out of here. But the big kicker came when I had a couple of months of sobriety, and I wanted to die. I wanted to kill myself. And I couldn't explain it, and it was just a thought, and it would not get out of my head. And then I'm like, see, David, you're not going to make it. Everybody else in AA is happy. Everybody else in AA is glad to be here. And look at you. You don't even appreciate what you've got. You know? And I thought, I went up there to tell my sponsor that I wanted to kill myself. And I thought he would say, well, I can't believe you, get out of here. This is for people who want it, or something like that. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, listen, and we walked way far away so nobody would hear it, you know? And I said, I don't think I'm going to make it here. All I want to do is, I can't stop thinking about killing myself. And he looked at me and he went, really? He went, that's great. And he started pounding my back and laughing, going, ha, 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 pow, pow. And, you know, I get a little, you know, and I start to tear up. And I'm thinking, I knew he was going to be mad, but I didn't think he was going to be happy, you know. And he goes, you don't get it, do you? And I said, no. And he said, listen to what you're saying. You're hurting. Yes. You're hurting so bad you want to die. Yes. But you don't want to take a drink. Listen to what you're saying, David. You would rather die than drink. And for a guy like you, that's big progress. And I went, oh my God. And I got a grin from here to here. I went, wow, I am getting better. And I ran back to my buddies. It's like, hey, I'd rather die than drink. You know, and they're like, yeah, okay. If it weren't for a sponsorship, I wouldn't be here. I later threw myself into the program, worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous more than once. I did lots of inventories. And for me, you know, I could only see so much at a time. And then I'd go back, and I'm not going to get into the argument whether it's another 10-step or another 4-step. I just did a lot of inventories and sat down with my sponsors and shared a lot of stuff. And for those first 5 years, I learned a lot about what was going on. And I learned, you know, about this selfishness at my core. I did not want to believe I was selfish. You know, but I just kept getting example after example after example of how incredibly selfish I was. And it was like, oh. And I always think, well, I'm beyond that now. And then, you know, wow, there it is again. And I kept going through the steps, and I kept doing this deal. And then this thing happened to me where I'm sober quite a few years, and a couple of events happen. You know, the first thing that happens is you go to a discussion meeting with about 40 people, and you've got more sobriety than anybody in the room, and it hits you like a ton of bricks. And you think, oh, no. No, I hope so-and-so shows up. Because I don't want this responsibility. I did not ask for this, okay? Because what happens is if you're the most sober guy in the room, everybody looks to you. Well, hey, Dave, you've got 5 years. What do you think? I don't want that. You know, that's not for me. And at the time, there were these people in AA, the guys like David Aronofsky, who passed away sober, and some other people, and they were my heroes. I looked at them, and I loved them, and I liked what they did. But then I saw how AA had a hold of them. I mean, you know, they were gone all the time talking and going places. And it seemed like they sponsored all these people and there was just all this. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm young. Now I've just now gotten my life back. You know, it's like I'm making money and I got a car and a boat and a truck and a 3-bedroom house in the suburbs and dental insurance and things are going my way. You know, I got places to go, people to meet and things to do, you know. And I'm thinking this in the back of my head. But then at the same time, I'm doing more AA than anybody I've ever seen. You know, it's like those are my trash cans, and if you try and empty them before I do, we're going to fight. You know, and I was like, I was Mr. doing this stuff all the time. And this little thing was coming up inside, and it's like, this isn't going to do it. This isn't going to cut it, and it's not going to make it for the long haul. And I had nobody to express that to. I had no way of voicing it because I was doing more than my sponsor at the time, way more. You know, I hardly ever saw him at meetings. And then this guy showed up. His name was Jim, and he came to Texas because his life had fallen apart, and he was coming down here trying to put it back together. And he'd been sober a long time. And I'd like to say that what happened was that I recognized who Jim was and asked him to be my sponsor. And the truth is that he was reaching out, and he saw me running around like a chicken with my head cut off. And he started talking to me, and he kind of roped me in. Said he needed a ride somewhere. Would I be able to help him out and give him a ride? Sure, I'll help you, old man. You know, so I'm giving him a ride. Boy, he knew how to hit those things, that relationship that failed and all this kind of stuff. And then I got to find out who he was, and I saw these crazy people that kept coming down from Oklahoma to spend time with him. You know, that's where I met David and Calvin. I thought, who are these goofs? You know, they're so happy all the time. And Jim Shaw said, you know, he changed my life. He saved my life, but he changed it. And what he did was he taught me about the principle of accountability. And, you know, the kind of AA, I hate to say this, I don't want to offend anybody, but it was North Dallas AA. That's what I called it, okay? You know, you went to meetings, you were sober, and you congratulated yourself on your innate intelligence that allowed you to recognize you had a problem and do something about it in time. There's not a whole lot of room for any higher power or anything like that. It's like, thank God I was smart enough to see what was going on. And that's what I saw, and that's what I knew, and that's what I thought was going on. And Jim talked to me like nobody had ever talked to me before. And there was something I knew about Jim, and that is he was rough. He was politically incorrect. He was loud. He was obnoxious. I mean, he had a booming voice. He actually deafened me one night, screaming at me in the cab of my truck from here up to Lake Levan. I couldn't, my ears were ringing. He was screaming at me the entire way, chewing me out. And, but he taught me a way to do AA that there was no wiggle room. You did what you said you were going to do when you said you were going to do it. And that was one of the most spiritual things that you could do. And I saw him live that way. You know, one of the ways I found out about that, his wife came up to me. I'd ask him to introduce me at my birthday. And that year, I was out of town a lot. And so I was going to celebrate in the winter, like November, December. And I said, Jim, would you introduce me? And he said, it'd be an honor and privilege. Okay, fine. Well, there was a big ice storm up in the Panhandle on that particular weekend that they had been up visiting Vinoy's parents or her mother. And Vinoy came up to me and said, David Moore, your sponsor almost killed all of us. I said, why? And she said, he was driving at 80, 90 miles an hour in that Cadillac on that ice. And I'm saying, slow down, Jim. And he's saying, I told that man I'd be at his birthday and I'm going to be there. And I can imagine, she told me they screamed at him all the way back. And he's just, you know, taking all these chances. When Jim came to my birthday, he just showed up for 10 minutes. You know, I mean, he was at the podium for less than 10 minutes, introduced me, gave me my chip, and I sat back down, and I found out about this later. And I said, Jim, oh my gosh, you didn't have to do that. If you hadn't showed, I'd have found somebody else. You didn't have to risk your life. And he said, I told you I'd be there, and I'm going to be there. I'd never seen that kind of commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous before. I tried to make jokes out of everything he did. Oh, really? Yeah, sure. And then he just stares at you. Oh, man, you mean that, don't you? You know, it's not funny. He really means it. Here's what happened. You know, Jim said things to me like, I'll go to hell and back with you, but I won't lead the way. Okay. This is a program that works in rough going. There's a line in Bill's story, and it means a lot to me. It says, if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his life, fails to perfect and enlarge his life through spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he will not survive the certain trials and low spots which lay ahead. And the operative word there is certain, trials and low spots. And the way you improve your spiritual life is work and self-sacrifice for others. At the group I was going to in North Dallas, we used to, there were guys who was like, want to go on a men's spiritual retreat? Yeah, what are y'all doing? We're going to go out in the woods and paint our bodies and get naked and beat the drum. No, I'll pass. But I'm serious. I mean, there were people who did that, okay? And that was spirituality. They were trying, but they weren't reading the book. But I'm just going to give you a little quick composite. Here's what happened. I got married after 9 years of sobriety, and I married this wonderful lady who was sober. And we had a great marriage for the first year or two. And then in the second year, things started getting weird, started falling apart. What's going on here? I'm on the phone to my sponsor. He'd since moved back to California. She's not going to meetings. She's not sponsoring anybody. Her sponsor moved away. She's going back to school, and she's at school all the time, but she's not at work, but she's not going to meetings. And when I want to go, she gets upset, and she, like, argues with me. And, you know, she says she'll go, but then when it's time to go, she's not ready. And I was late once. And he says, well, you'll never do that again. What do I do? And he says, you go when it's time to go. And leave her? And he says, yep. I said, oh, my God, there'll be fireworks. He says, well, you do it because you're not going to be late to a meeting. And late on time is 30 minutes early, okay? And he taught me things like don't ever say no to an AA request. I never saw him say no to an AA request. And I saw him do some pretty damned inconvenient things. I saw some people with some sense of humor or thought they were going to jack with Jim, and they asked him to do some things, and he said yes. You know, they thought, well, he won't want to say yes to this. And he said yes. And so then all this stuff happens. And here's what else happened. My first wife, my daughter was about to turn 18, and my first wife was suing me for a lot of money. I went to my attorney and I said, look at this letter. And he goes, He says, okay, she's going to get, I can't remember how many thousands of dollars it was. And I said, well, I don't have it. He goes, well, she's going to get it. I said, I don't have it. And he says, she's not going to get it. And I said, wait a minute, I don't have it. And he goes, she's going to get it. And I'm like, oh, my God. At the same time, my brother, who had been sick for years, got diagnosed with end-stage liver disease. That was what was wrong with him. He's in Baylor in four-point restraints out of his mind waiting for a liver transplant because when the ammonia levels would build up, he wouldn't know who or what he was or where he was. And I'd go over and see my parents, and they're crying, and they've got his two little girls. And they're saying, we're too old to raise these little girls. The thing about my ex-wife was she was having an affair with a guy I sponsored. Oh, my God. You know, click hand grenade, throw it in that group. Boom. You know, there are people getting drunk just on the edges of that. I didn't even tell my parents what was going on. I'm getting sued. My brother's dying. I go over to my parents' house and I say, listen. Oh, and my sister-in-law, when they found out he needed a transplant, they fired her from her job. Because they didn't want to pay for it on the insurance. And she wound up going into a treatment center for a mental. And so I told my parents I didn't know how, but if necessary, I would raise my my two nieces. And I would call my sponsor on the phone. And I'd say, this all hit in 30 days. Okay? This all happened at once. And I called my sponsor on the phone, and it's like everything's falling apart. And he'd say, okay, David, you've got 2 minutes. Go. I had 2 minutes to talk about myself. I'd say, well, okay, I'm going to lose the house at the lake, but I get to keep my truck. My central air's out, but nobody can come fix it because I don't have any credit. And I'm going to go on. He'd go, time. Tell me about the people you sponsor. Start at the top with the first one. Tell me how long they're sober and what step they're working on. I couldn't talk about me anymore. And I only got to call him once a week. It better be big if I called him. See, because he knew this. He knew that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous would carry me through this difficult time. Okay? He never said, David, I want you to go home and get in touch with your feelings. You know, my feelings were to crawl at the top of this Lawler Park over here with my high-powered rifle, get up on that water tower, and get my name in the paper and take you with me. Okay? I got terminated. I'm not terminated. I got sent home from work because I was such a basket case. They said, you know, we don't want you driving our trucks. Why don't you go home and take a rest? Great, 12 years of sobriety. I'm on mental disability. What a picture of the program I am. But he told me I'd walk through it with dignity and grace and that I would do the right thing. My brother got a liver transplant. My sister got out. My dad called me up and said, do you think your ex-wife would take $5,000? I said, what difference does it make? I don't have $5,000. He says, well, I do. Ask her. So I called her and she said, sure. And, you know, my father did that because I paid him back all the money that he owed me before for bailing me out of jail and all those tires and things he bought. I said, you don't know how much I owe you, do you? And he goes, just a minute. Dates and amounts. And I'm like, wow, okay, I guess you do. I paid him back. And he knew I was good for it, and he gave me the money. And shortly after that, I'm sitting there with my sponsor. It took about a year or so. And I'm sitting with him, and we're at this men's retreat at Lake Levan. It's the first time I've seen him since all this went down. And you know what? I'm sitting there beside him, and I'm going, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to make it. And see, when all this started to happen, I thought I'd probably stay sober, but I'm going to be one of those guys. Oh, yeah, Dave's been sober a long time, but stay away from him because he's crazy. I thought I was going to be one of those guys that sits in the corner of the group and babbles. You know, oh, yeah, he's sober a long time. Say hi, Dave. You know, I thought because my brain's going to break, I can't take all this. But I did the right thing. You know, I thought crazy thoughts, but I didn't act on them. You know, one time I saved myself by imagining trying to explain what I'd done to my sponsor. Of course, I'd be calling from jail, and he would say, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. What did you? And I thought that through, and I thought, I can't do that either. Brother got okay. The money showed up. And a week after my ex-wife and I were divorced, her psychiatrist called and said, would you come down? We need to commit her, and I want you to come down. And I said, we're divorced. And he goes, yeah, but there's nobody in your life that cares about her. Because she'd gone back out and blown 10 years of sobriety and had threatened to kill herself. And her psychiatrist wanted her put away. Here's what I realized. That if I'd have said no to AA, if I'd have said one less prayer, gone to one less meeting, somebody said, will you sponsor me? Said no. Said, will you come talk? And I said, no. I want to watch. Man, it's Monday Night Football. If I'd have done that. See, because I thought that you did all the steps and what happened was you got to win. But what happens is if you do everything and bust your hump, like it says, and try really hard, you get to stay sober. This right here is the greatest life I've ever had. This is fantastic. Let me say this and I'll shut up. If y'all, statistically, many of us in this room are going to die drunk. I don't want it to be me. Okay? I don't want it, but statistically, a lot of us are going to die drunk. If you leave this program and you decide to go out and start drinking and somebody comes up to you and says, hey, weren't you in AA? Tell them the truth. Okay? Because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. Look at them and say, AA works, but I didn't work AA. Because AA does work. If AA didn't work, I wouldn't be standing here. Thank you all for your time and your attention. Thank you.
Thanks, Josh. How about Jim?
Jimmy! Jimmy!
My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
And glad Josh went first there. I was looking at our principles there, and accountability. I've had to think a little bit about that one this week. Somebody kind of caught me in a little bit of a wrong this week, and kind of busted me on it, and I was kind of embarrassed and a little bit PO'd and everything, and I kind of thought about the way I would have reacted a few months ago, and it would have been just outright anger, and if not physical violence, then certainly verbal abuse, and who knows what, you know, after a few drinks, it probably would have been worse. But, you know, I was thinking about the tools that we're given in this program, and you know, the different things. I mean, anyway, I'm just glad that I've got those now and that I don't have to resort to the kind of things that I used to do. Thanks.
I guess we should hear from their leader, Danny.
Hi, I'm Danny Kroll, alcoholic.
Hi, Danny.
April 24th to 94 is my sobriety date. And David, looking forward to hearing you talk. And Robert, thanks for coming with him, and welcome to everyone else, especially our visitors. And anyway, I think what I've been thinking about the most lately is this is a sure sign that I'm rapidly approaching middle age, but there's a song by Amy Grant that talks about God's word being a lamp into her feet and a light into her path. And so I've learned what that phrase means, and apparently in biblical times they didn't have flashlights and they didn't have lamp posts and street lights and things like that. So if you're going somewhere at night, you needed to have some candles. I guess they had a way to attach them to their shoes, and so they could see enough to take the next step in front of them, but they couldn't see the whole path. And that's what God's word was compared to. And so, you know, really the way that applies to my life now is, I guess it was about a month ago, I, you know, heard some news that my source of income was going to be drastically shifted. And so, and actually no guarantee of anything to replace it. And so, you know, really just I've had to spend a lot of time praying in the last month about that, and just, you know, relying on the one day at a time idea that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love in the Lord's Prayer what says, give us this day our daily bread. And, you know, thinking about that, that's what God promises us is, you know, is our daily bread and enough to sustain us today. And, you know, sometimes I can trust in that and be at peace with it, and other times I'm just not okay with that at all. But, you know, it's really been a neat experience over the last month, and you're really just having a sense of peace about a lot of that, and that knowing that, you know, God's always taking care of me, and that, you know, today things are fine. And, you know, things have, you know, that situation has since been adjusted. And I guess the last thing is that I don't know if this is an alcoholic trait or if this is just a human trait, but, you know, I've always wanted to be set for life. You know, I've not really chased my daily bread, but, you know, how can I get set for life? And that is, you know, that's not what God gives me, but He does give me what I need today. And I'm grateful for that, because if He did set me for life, I'd probably no longer seek His will, and I'd probably just go drink myself to death. And I like being here tonight better. Thanks.
How about Steve? Steve Connor, alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
I've been sober since February 16th of 2004. And David, looking forward to hearing you talk, and welcome to the newcomers. I guess what I've been thinking about this week, since we've been reading in the big book on Monday night about we agnostics, you know, I've been trying to figure out, try to look around for some spiritual principles, you know, and try to just really improve my contact that I have with my higher power. Because, you know, I've heard a lot of stuff, and we've been reading in the book, and it keeps on going back to working with others and, you know, and this spiritual connection. And so I've been really trying to seek that out to the best of my ability. And, you know, what I'm finding out is that, you know, I fall short a lot of times. And when something good happens in my life, you know, I want to take credit for it right off the bat, you know. And then when something goes bad, I want to, you know, point the finger or question, you know, why didn't it go my way? And, you know, it's kind of like I've heard Mike and them, you know, when something's not going my way, I just want to pick my ball up and go home. And, you know, that I've, you know, yesterday was a good example of how, you know, at work yesterday, you know, my boss went to Houston, and so, you know, we're in the office by ourselves. And so, needless to say, this morning we had a meeting early this morning. You know, I guess he came back in and checked some of the history on the computers yesterday and found out that we weren't working all day long. So, you know, just, you know, having to deal with that kind of stuff, you know, and go in there and just thinking, you know, that, you know, really, I mean, you know, what am I doing when nobody's really looking? And, you know, most of the time, you know, even though I'm not, you know, at first I came into this program, I thought, man, I'm going to quit drinking, and that's going to be the end of it. My life's going to get better, you know, and that'll be it. You know, I'll do a little AA, and, you know, that's going to be, you know, things are going to be good. But what I found out is that, you know, take the alcohol away from me, and I'm still, I mean, I'm sick, you know, and I still end up going, you know, getting off the path and doing things that aren't right. But, the thing that I'm grateful for more than anything is that, you know, there's a group of guys here that, you know, that have been through what I'm going through, that are accountable to each other, and, you know, that get me back on track, you know. And I at least today I can recognize, you know I made a mistake yesterday at work. You know, I didn't give my boss, you know, I cheated my boss out of a day, basically. And so today I tried to go, I mean, tomorrow I'm going to go in and try to just work like it's my first day again, and just to, you know, remember wherever I'm at and whatever I'm doing, you know, that it's a reflection on AA. You know, I got to make an amends recently to an employer that I had stole from. And it was just, you know, the response I got from him wasn't anything that I expected, you know. I mean, he just, you know, it blew him away, you know. And he just said, I respect what you're trying to do with your life, you know. I really don't know about your problems you had before, because we didn't really talk. But, you know, whatever you're doing now, it seems to be working, and keep on doing what you're doing. And, you know, I'll take this money, we'll put it in your file, and if you ever need a job, you know, you might want to come back here first. And I thought, man, this is weird. So, you know, anyway, you know, I'm grateful for this home group. I'm grateful for the guys in it, the fellowship, because when I got here, there was nobody who wanted to be around me. Basically, my parents, you know, and the people that loved me the most were just kind of putting up with me, hoping that maybe I would change. But, you know, everybody here just kind of pulled me in, and it's a great group of guys, and I'm grateful to be a part of it. Thank you. Thanks. I would call on your sponsor, but I'd call on mine, Mike.
Thanks, Doug. I'm Mike Erickson. I'm alcoholic.
Mike.
Hi, buddy. July 19th, 87 is my sobriety date. David, welcome. Welcome the rest of the Sherman contingent. Glad you guys are here. Julie, welcome to you. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm glad to see you here. And Tom, it's Thomas, right? Tommy, good to see you, man. You know, I used to drink. That's consequently why I'm here. I mean, I used to. What happens to me when I take a drink of alcohol is that I didn't know. Upon coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, putting it all together, I didn't know what happened. I didn't really know what was wrong with me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I was getting in trouble. I knew I had a lot of family members that were hacked off at me. I knew I was having problems at work. I knew that I was, you know, those things, the anvils seemed to be falling on me at every turn. There was just, and my life seemed a perpetual struggle. You know, just a struggle. One, just a grind. Everything's a grind. And the more it got into the grind, it seemed like the more I drank. The worse matters got, the more I drank. The worse the pressure came down, the more I drank. And see, here's the deal that I never could reconcile with, was that, gosh, what could one drink hurt? What really could go wrong with taking one drink? That can't be that bad of a deal. But see, what I never knew was what was wrong with me. I never knew that I had a physical allergy to alcohol, that once I took a drink, it would kick off this craving, this allergic reaction that would condemn me to drink until I ran out, passed out, or blacked out. I never knew that was going to happen to me when I started to drink. And you know what? It wasn't until I spent a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous that I understood what happened to me when I took a drink. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with the idea that most newcomers get here with is that if I stop drinking, I'll be okay. And Steve talked about it. I eliminated alcohol from my life for a little while, and my life didn't get better. It got worse because now I was living face to face with all the facts about my life, that I was guilty all the time. I had to live with the fact that I'd hurt so many people, that I failed at so many tasks. You know what happened, though, is that I stayed around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to get something in my life called a sponsor, a man that basically sat down with me and interweaved those 12 principles into my life. And what happened is when those 12 principles are practiced on a daily basis, it expelled the obsession to use alcohol. And I think very simply why is because I started changing the way I was living my life. I started taking direction from someone who was living their life well and started following what he did. And no, I didn't, by no means did I do this thing with 100% perfection. I failed at a lot of turns, but I kept walking in the right direction. And slowly but surely, just by taking that simple step behind someone who showed me how to do it, 17 years have elapsed, and I don't know how that's happened. I really don't. I don't have the slightest idea how that time has accumulated, other than the fact that I just haven't left you. And I haven't died. And for some reason, you know, those principles are grounded enough that I keep doing them. And that's the great thing that I think Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. That if you're sitting here in a meeting and you cannot control and enjoy the way you drink, if once you start to drink, all bets are off. You don't know what's going to happen. Well, this is a place for people like that, where people like that can come and get better. And all it does, it's really not too much to ask, because in the wings lies death and misery. That's what lies in the wings for me to keep drinking. And this, you know, it's really not too bad being sober. I was scared to death coming in here, and now I find it's that this is really what I want to do. And this is really what I want to do. All the job and all that stuff is just secondary stuff. This is really where I want to be and really what I want to do today. And I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
About Robert. I'm Robert, alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 6th of 96, and with a sponsorship and a commitment to home group and working with others, my chances are really good. I'm convinced of that. I used to drink a lot, and I don't drink at all anymore. And people that aren't familiar with recovery and alcoholism find out about that, and they go, huh? That, you know, confused puppy dog look. And they go, never? I said, nope. Why? And I tell them the truth. I don't do it very well. You know, I mean, that's everything they need to know at that point. And, you know, that's what it was like. And if you guys, if you're alcoholic, you're familiar with all the disasters that goes on. And what it's like today, I went to a meeting last night. And it's not my home group, but my home group doesn't meet often enough for all the meetings that I need, so I regularly attend there. And what I'm doing is covert action. Yeah, I'm in there, I sit across from the door about like this, and when I see a face I have never met before, boom, I'm on him. And I stick my hand out and I say, hi, man, I'm Robert. I've never met you before. Is this your first meeting? Have you been coming around here lately? And sometimes I just haven't met him before, and they've been there coming around to all these. But last night it was a guy, it was his third meeting ever. He'd just gotten out of jail, and it was a speaker meeting, and the speaker was great, the step speaker. He was, there was no humorous antidotes for an hour. He was
pounding out the AA gospel, you know, about the fourth and fifth step. And I'm sitting, and I had the guy sitting next to me, and I was watching him, and he's going, you know, he was, do what? You know, I could just see it as that, do what? Say, you know, he was just, and I was just, I was right back there thinking, this is just alien concept. You know, and if you're new, this is alien. This is radical stuff for an alcoholic to do. And you know what? That's what spirituality looks like in me. When I'm reaching out for a guy that I've never met, and I say, hi, come on in, get some coffee, sit by me, you know. What, how'd you get here? Oh, that's the worst story I ever heard a guy ever tell, you know. Just make him welcome. And you know what? When the meeting was over, I gave him my number. And more importantly, I got his number. There's no escape. Yeah, because I'm going to call him. You know, if he doesn't call me, I'm going to call him. Because I invite him to a meeting Saturday. I said, come on, come see what we're doing. Because my chances is that I'll get to express the idea to him that rarely has a person failed who's thoroughly followed this path. Man, that means almost never. I mean, that's good. Those are good odds. The trick is to get him to thoroughly follow this path. Man, I like what I'm doing today, and I like what AA is about, and I like what I'm doing. Thank you very much.
How about Chris? Bert.
Chris.
My name is Chris Bert, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober since December 20th, 1988, and had an interesting deal at the jail / treatment center that we go to on Tuesday nights down in Wilmer. A guy that I had presented some facts to got quite upset with me couple of months ago when he first came in, and he came up to the meeting after the meeting on Tuesday night and apologized. You know, said, hey, man, I had a resentment against you, and your name was everything but Chris, and on and on and on. And, you know, he shared some stuff with me and whatnot. And, you know, that's why I come back. That's what my sponsor is to me, is my sponsor gives me stuff that is just the truth. You know, it's not, it doesn't go through this processing center up here in my head and somehow filters through and makes it, you know, okay for me to do whatever or say whatever or live however. You know, my sponsor is that brutal honesty that smashes that, and it keeps me grounded and keeps me going to those places that remind me of, you know, of who I am, the treatment centers and the CRIP program and the treatment center on Saturday, you know, and it, I have to have that in my life. If I don't, you know, I know exactly what it's like. You know, it's I drink a lot. It's good to be here tonight. Thanks.
You know what? I can't remember your name, but my sponsor calls you Ear. Come on.
Scott.
Hi, my name's Scott. I'm an alcoholic. This is my first time up here at the podium, so I'm a little nervous. Yeah, this week went good. Being a week and a half sober, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott. How about Mitch?
I'm Mitchell McCabe, alcoholic. I'm sober since July 1st of 99. For that, I'm truly grateful. David, it's good to see you again. Robert, I like what you said. I used to drink a lot. Today, I don't drink. And that was kind of my story. John and I were talking on the way. I picked him up, and we were talking on the way out here and how, you know, we're talking about how, you know, once we start, we can't stop. And that was pretty much my story. You know, and Mike was talking about how, you know, alcohol basically, you know, I would have thought that if I quit drinking that everything would get better, and I thought that too. And as a matter of fact, when I first went into treatment in 92, you know, I thought, well, if I just quit doing drugs, I'll quit getting in trouble. And then they said something about I had to quit drinking. I went, oh, no, that's, no. You know, and anyway, you know, today, you know, I found out, you know, when I quit drinking, that life just gets crazy, you know. And so that's where, you know, sponsorship kicks in and a home group and working these steps and working with others, and you know, I'm grateful that, you know, today I still got a new guy to work with, you know. Had one for a while and he went somewhere else, and now I got another one, and I don't know what that's all about, but you know, I'm really grateful that I get a phone call every morning and that I get to sit down every Sunday and read the book with someone, because to me, you know, from having been in the program and then relapsing and then coming back in, I know today it's all about, you know, helping others and giving it away, and you know, that's really what this whole program is about, and you know, I think that's what helps a goof like me make it. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Let's hear from that morning phone call. Come on, Brad.
Hi, I'm Brad Hester. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Brad.
Hi. You know, I, well, where do I start, man? So much to say. I'll just try and keep it as brief as I can. You know, I find that I'm a skeptic in everything that I do. I'm skeptical about what people say. You know, I go to this aftercare. I'm, you know, one of the Cornell graduates. And I've been coming here, I guess, for 6 months now, but I've been out of the program for 3 months. But I, you know, I'm sitting in there and I just, I want you all to know that every one of you has said something at one point or another over the course of the time that I've been coming here that has really been able for me to identify with. Mostly a lot of things Mike says I can identify with, and it helps me feel more at home. And I think to myself too, when Mike says he's been here 17 years, I've been here 3 months, you know, out of the program, and I think to myself, how am I ever going to make it 17 years? You know, I'm skeptical about my, you know, chances. You know, I've got 8 years on probation and things like that. But then Mike says, you know, just do, or as Doug said, as when I called him the other morning at the, you know, anyway, Doug said, just do what we do, Brad. Just be on, you know, on time to meetings and get involved and participate. And anyway, I'm very appreciative of this group because you've given me my my pitiful, you know, life back to some degree, and I've made my life worth living now. You know, I'm working, I have health insurance, I have money, I'm free, most importantly, and I'm alive, and I really can't attribute that to anything other than when I came to this program, I was totally defeated. When I was, arrested back in January, I felt like my life had ended, and I knew that my life had become terribly unmanageable, and I was, up to that point, I was too afraid to admit that. But through my sponsor and, you know, coming to these groups and listening to other people that I look up to in here and seeing that I can see myself in them and, you know, and, you know, they can identify with how I felt and am feeling, it really is a very moving experience for me, and I'm very appreciative. Thanks.
There's no smoking in the church, so if you smoke, please do so outside and use the button.